So mine, I don't know if you heard, I got engaged. And we're...
We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for April 22nd, 2015. Apologize for the slight delay, members. Senator Wicklund, Senate File 1066. Welcome, Senator Wicklund. And I see an A2 delete all amendment. Appears to be your first stop. So
yes.
An author's amendment, Senator Wicklund?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate if someone could offer the author's amendment.
Senator Reinhart moves the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Members will work off of A2. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm here today to present Senate File 1066, which is clarifying authority for political subdivisions, imposing and collecting local lodging taxes. This bill has been brought forward to me by the City of Bloomington, but does affect many cities in the state of Minnesota. The bill language, as amended, will fix a loophole that in law that results in decreased tax collections on local lodging taxes in some jurisdictions in Minnesota due to the way that travel intermediaries, for example, Expedia, Travelocity, et cetera, break down the costs on the price of hotel rooms. Presently, the state collects local lodging taxes for a small number of cities. However, most cities collect their own local lodging tax. For those cities where the Department of Revenue collects on their behalf, the travel intermediaries are subject to local or lodging tax on the entire full lodging tax collection. However, if a city is collecting their own local lodging tax, sales tax is only being paid for the wholesale price of the room, but not on the booking fee, and therefore not on the total charged to the consumer. Because of this, travel intermediaries can offer hotel rooms at a lower rate than a local Minnesota hotelier due to taxes not paid and remitted on the booking fee portion of lodging accommodations. It shouldn't matter if a customer books a room through a hotel chain website or through an intermediary website, but because of the way the statute is written, it does matter today, and in the case of Bloomington, results in considerable lost revenues. This bill clarifies that lodging tax is due on the full amount of a room, and this is regardless of who collects the tax, the state or the city. This clarification of statute is necessary to level the playing field between travel intermediaries and Minnesota businesses. This issue is significant to Bloomington, which has more than 35 hotels within the city limits, but the bill would also assist other Minnesota communities. And I have testifiers here today from the City of Bloomington, as well as General Manager from the Airport Marriott to speak to the bill. And first, I'd like to have Shane Redling speak. He's the Port Authority Administrator from Bloomington.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. And as the testifiers are testifying, as I've looked at this, I'm a little uncertain about exactly what's going on, and I'm trying to understand how the tax is going to be paid on something other than the actual amount that the room is rented for. So if you could explain that to the committee, and then understand the difference between what's happening in the four cities that are state-administered and the locally administered. That would be helpful for the committee. So thank you. Mr. Redling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I will try to answer those questions in my testimony. How this works is when a person goes to book a hotel room on the Internet, you may search for Marriott, for example, and your first hit on Google might be the Marriott website. And if you were to book the room through the Marriott website proper, you would pretend it's a $100 hotel room. You would pay tax on that $100, and so your room would end up being $100 plus the tax. However, if you book through an OTC website, Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, etc., while you will think you are paying $100 for the room, what you're actually paying is some portion of that $100 to the hotel itself and some portion as the booking fee to the online travel company, the OTC. So in a theoretical example, you could be paying $80 to the hotel and $20 to the OTC as a booking fee. And tax is only being paid on the $80. So this is generally invisible to the customer as you're booking rooms through the through the internet. But what's happening behind the scenes, because of the way that the statute is written, is the OTC charges the hotel a booking fee of $20 in this example, and it's not being the lodging tax isn't being applied to that booking fee because of the way the statute is written today. So what this legislation does is clarify that lodging tax is due on the whole consideration that a person pays, regardless if you're booking it through a Marriott website or an online travel company website or otherwise. It just really levels the playing field between Minnesota businesses and the online travel companies and is supported by the local hoteliers, which are, of course, Minnesota businesses.
And Mr. Redling, could you say your name so we can, for the record, we can put your name with a voice?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry. My name is Shane Rudlang. I'm the Port Authority Administrator for the City of Bloomington.
Okay. And then I have Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, good luck. I can remember very vividly this same conversation a few years ago in this room when we fixed the sales tax problem, the state sales tax problem related to the same thing, and the former Commissioner of Revenue was in the room, and he probably remembers it. And I can remember the conversation about one of these companies could actually set up a kiosk in the lobby. And if you bought your room at the kiosk, your sales tax obligation would be less than if you bought it at the registration desk. So I guess I wasn't aware we hadn't fixed it for the lodging tax portion, but I remember when we fixed it for the sales tax. It took a little while, but it is the right thing to do. I want to thank Senator Wicklund for bringing this, because I'm sure it affects the city of Duluth that Senator Reiner and I represent also in the city.
Well, and Senator Bach, it might be novel, but I explained to Senator Wicklund that we were very undecided about this issue, and we were looking forward to hearing from the both sides of the issue as we were trying to resolve it, because it is a little difficult to get our heads around. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rutling, so I want to make sure I get this right. If I go online and I book it, let's just use the $100 number. At the end of the day, the price that I see that I'm paying as a customer, is it the same right now, whether I book online or I went to that Marriott site? Because you're saying the tax isn't paid on that part, but is the actual final bill the same?
Mr. Redley.
Mr. Chair and members, the answer is it depends. In some cases, and I've done this myself, I've gone on the Radisson Blue website, our a new hotel in town, and tried to book a room a week out, and the final price that I would pay on that room, while the room charge itself was $179, the actual final bill was about $120 off, because there was less tax being charged if I booked through the OTC website. And there are other examples where the fees may be different. But in general, and the experience that I have that I'll testify to is that the final charge was less on the OTC website than if I booked through the Radisson Blue site proper.
And Senator Gazelka, the other part of this is that if they do this in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bowabic, and one other city, they're treated differently because it's state collected, where these are locally administered, so they have different treatment. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of what we're trying to sort out. We want everybody to be treated the same, and then we got to figure out which way to go with it. Yeah. Senator Gazelka.
And Mr. Chair, the reason why I asked the question the way I did is at the end of the day, if we make a shift where they go online and the payment appears more, you know, then we're shifted. It's not really a level playing field to the customer. We're kind of, you know, and I'm not saying that's the case. That's why I'm trying to understand the issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This reminds me a little bit of the e-fairness discussion that we've had, not just in this chamber, but certainly across the nation as well. And in addition to that, I just wanted to clarify the difference in cost not only has to do with how the taxes are collected, whether they be locally or state collected, but how does a local option sales tax fit into that difference in the number? So in other words, going online, I understand you to say that the booking would not include the local lodging tax, and so there would be a difference in the cost. It would appear lower. How does the local option sales tax figure into that? I assume that is treated the same way.
Senator Nelson, maybe Ms. Pollack.
Ms. Pollack might be.
Ms. Pollack?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the local general sales taxes are collected by the Department of Revenue, that is not an issue in this case. It's only the local lodging taxes that are not collected by the department that are, as Mr. Rudling testified to, kind of getting lost in the collection process.
Okay. Senator
Nelson.
So that makes me wonder if perhaps that provides a model then for how we might be able to collect the local option lodging taxes.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Rudling.
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Nelson, and it came up in the House Taxes Committee that the OTCs may or may not be paying the lodging tax even when the Department of Revenue is collecting the tax. So in Minneapolis, for example, that may be a question if there are testifiers here from the OTCs to mine that issue more. I'm not versed in that, but it did come up on the House side. And what this proposed language does is it clarifies for those cities as well that the local lodging tax applies to the entire consideration that a customer pays. And then it also clarifies that no matter who collects, that same thing is true. So levels the playing field between DOR and city collected taxes, and it clarifies, I think, once and for all that what the legislature intended was to apply the tax, all the taxes, to the full consideration paid by the customer, no matter which website you were using.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Wren. Did you have some prepared testimony that you'd like to continue with, or have we covered your?
Mr. Chair and members, that would conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much. Ms. Economy Scholler?
Yes. My name is Lori Economy Scholler. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Bloomington. I just have a few comments. This tax change would keep more money within the state because the OTCs would be funneling it back either to there's approximately 50 cities within the state of Minnesota that have this lodging sales tax, and it would, and in those 50 cities, they do reimburse their or send 95% of that onto their convention bureaus within their location. So it's not just Bloomington, it's throughout the state that would be able to collect that. We do estimate very conservatively that should this change go through, this would help us through approximately about $200,000 on a very conservative basis coming into our general fund. We would also have approximately $150,000 coming in that would go to our convention bureau. So this is a significant amount of money that would help our city. And then there are a number, as it was imposed already through some of the bigger ones, the online travel companies do pay a number of other cities throughout the country, New York City, the state of New York, state and local jurisdictions in South Carolina, District of Columbia, both state and local jurisdictions in Georgia, the state of North Carolina, and Durham County in North Carolina. So how they're paying their lodging sales tax on this intermare, on the OTCs, it is pretty much across the country, and it's increasing.
Thank you, Ms. Economy Scholler. Mr. Oswald.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Senators. My name is Todd Oswald, and I am on the Board of Directors for the Bloomington Visitors and Convention Bureau. I've been a hotelier in the city of Bloomington for 28 years, and I'm very proud to see our industry grow in the city of Bloomington. I've written a statement here this morning that I'd like to read to you. The current legislation puts our hotels at a competitive disadvantage in the way the OTC pricing is lower than the pricing for one of the reasons being due to the fact of the differential in taxes. They're able to discount the rate lower because they are paying the taxes on the wholesale pricing and not the retail pricing. All hotels in the state of Minnesota are required to pay city, state, and occupancy tax. There should be made no exception to the OTC companies to not pay the full retail tax on these rooms sold. Portions of our hotels' taxes are paid to the aid of promoting our cities and states' tourism, which ensures a strong economy and employment. As the age of the internet excels at a rapid pace, the OTC are paying for top page placement on many of the most popular internet search engines. For many of the less seasoned travelers, they will type in a major hotel brand name that they would like to stay at. Many times the OTC will come up first on the page, and these travelers will book through the OTC, sometimes not even knowing that they've actually booked through the OTC and thought they were booking through the hotel company itself. The OTC drive 100% of their revenue through the internet, and again, we should be collecting the correct amount of taxes on this revenue. It should not matter to the website a consumer books through and what rate, but what is more important is that we collect the correct tax. Although we as hoteliers are in partnership with the OTC, I am not talking about the partnership this morning in the booking rooms. I'm talking about us all being on the same level playing field when it comes to charging and the state collecting these taxes. We should not allow the OTC to receive a differential tax treatment. Many of the OTCs will want to confuse legislation with words like administration fees, service fees for facilitating the transaction. Therefore, they believe they do not have to pay the occupancy tax. Please don't let this terminology fool us. Many of those opposing this bill may feel that the collection of these taxes may be burdensome, but in reality, it is money that we can and will use to promote tourism in our state. We must have stronger laws in effect to tighten the loopholes in the current statute. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Senator Gazal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One brief question. So who determines the amount of the fee? Do they do, or do you determine that?
We do not determine the amount of the fee. They do.
All right. So, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to think through this as processing it. So what they agree on for the hotel price is between the two of you, and that's where I see the lodging tax, and then the fee is up to them to charge what they want or don't want to charge. But, you know, I get where you're coming from. I'm just trying to sort through this as far as what makes this a level playing field versus what potentially gives you an advantage. I don't know.
Mr. Oswald.
If I could clarify that, Senator. We as hoteliers will sell to the OTC sleeping rooms at a set rate that we feel during the time of the season, during the time of the week, whatever we want to sell it to the OTC. It is then determined by the OTC what they sell that room at. We don't determine any difference than what we sell at a wholesale. What they sell at retail is up to them.
Senator Sanjo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the room this morning, I'm not sure. I don't see an overwhelming outgrowth of people that are going to come in and testify against this. So if there were, what would be the opposing testimony towards this?
Senator Sanjo.
Yes.
Mr. Inus is going to come up.
Oh, all right. He'll
give
us that. All right. Well, then I'll change my question.
Senator Sanjo.
Will bottom line, how will this affect the person that actually is renting a hotel room?
Yeah, that's very good. I mean, are they going to pay more? Are they going to pay less? What's the outcome? Mr. Rudnick.
Mr. Chair, members, as I mentioned before, when I went to book the Radisson Blu roughly a week out, the price that I paid through the Radisson Blu website, the ultimate price, was slightly higher through the Radisson Blu website and slightly lower through the OTC. Some hotels have agreements with the OTCs that the core price is set. For example, when I did that for Radisson Blu, the charge, that the first number that you see was $179 for that room, no matter what website you were on, either Radisson Blu's or Orbitz or Travelocity. And so the differential was, when you get to the end, when you're checking out at the end of your transaction online, that the service fee slash taxes that get tacked on to the end is what changes. And to add a little more to the question that was asked earlier about, you know, how much is the booking fee, I've had a conversation with another hotelier in town who was not able to make it today because of a conference that he has this week. Some hotels have agreements with these OTCs that the core price, the $179, is going to be the same no matter what hotel or what website you're on. And so the way they do it is they say, we want the wholesale price to be X, and then the booking fee is predetermined. So on that $179 room, they might say, okay, we're willing to let this room go for $150. And then the service fee is, of course, the $29 on top of that. And so they know on the front end what the service fee is. The core price is constant no matter what website you're on, and that's how it works.
And Senator, so Mr. Chair, to Senator Senchum, we're going to hear from Mr.
So bottom line, we would expect the customer to pay a little bit more. Is that true?
Mr. Rudling.
Mr. Chair and members, yes. Okay. And like in the example that I did, that's true.
Okay.
Senator Senchum, the other complicating thing is, if they're in Minneapolis, it's dealt with differently. And so when we're done with Mr. Ines, we're going to have the department come up and kind of walk us through what's going on in Minneapolis versus what's going on when it's locally collected.
Okay.
Anything else? Anything else you'd like to add? Anything? Let's get Mr. Ines to come up, and we only need one spot, and they want to stay there. Mr. Ines.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, here on behalf of the Travel Tech Association. The Travel Tech Association is a trade association of online travel companies such as Orbitz, Expedia, Travelocity, Priceline, TripAdvisor, et cetera. And we're here to voice our strong opposition to Senate file, I think it's 1099 or 1066. You know, I think one thing maybe has been missed here is that this bill, as it's currently drafted, would impose more than 125 distinct and specific local lodging taxes on a broad segment of the hospitality industry. The conversation has been framed around online travel companies, like who I represent, but the definition of travel intermediary is far broader than online travel companies. Revenue has published a revenue notice on travel intermediaries, and they've defined them in the following way. It's a very broad definition. Accommodation intermediaries include vacation rental, home operators, travel consolidators, tour operators, and any other person that facilitates a sale of lodging as well as charges a room charge to the customer. So this would include travel agencies. This would include wedding planners that book a room on behalf of their clients. So we talk about the online travel companies, but this is a much broader universe of hospitality industries that would be impacted by the imposition of more than 125 local lodging taxes. I think it's good to go back and lay the foundation of how we got to where we are currently. In 2011, as Senator Bach accurately stated, the legislature decided to impose the general sales tax to travel intermediaries. They amended 297A, which is a general sales tax chapter, and they imposed that tax. We were opposed to that, but you're imposing one universal tax, generally applied tax, statewide, no problem. I mean, we didn't like it, but we understand that. If they had wanted to also include the local lodging taxes, they certainly knew how to do that. They could have simply amended Chapter 469, which is a local lodging statute of law, and looped in all the local lodging taxes. They made an informed and, you know, and rational decision that imposing 125 disparate taxes, different rates, different tax bases, different geography, was not in the best interest and of the hospitality industry. So I think this isn't a clarification. This isn't a loophole that the legislature was somehow unaware of and decided not to address. This was a conscious decision to apply the tax statewide to the general sales tax, but not do so to 125 different disparate local lodging taxes. You know, so I think that is kind of the gist of it. Also, I think there's a persistent myth about the business model of online travel companies. You know, we purchase blocks of rooms and we sell and we control inventory. We do none of that. This issue has been litigated throughout the country. The courts have consistently held that there's no factual basis for concluding that online travel companies are accommodation providers. We do not resell rooms. We do not control inventory. We are a facilitator of a transaction between the customer and the lodging establishment. We aggregate information so consumers can make an informed choice. They can do comparison shopping and the like. And we are a conduit. We are really a facilitator of that transaction. All the applicable and legally owed taxes are paid by the hotelier, by the total amount of consideration that's remitted by the customer to the hotelier. So this whole, all these moving parts about, well, there's this fee over here. And the reality is the appropriate taxes are being paid. Imposing 125 disparate taxes would not be a good sound policy.
Mr. Innes, can you tell us what the difference is between the locally administered and the state-administered taxes? And, I mean, we're treating these wide-ranging industries differently, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and two other cities, than we are everywhere else.
Chairman, it's a great question, and it really was, I mean, it was a function of the 2011 law change, but it was really came out of a Department of Revenue interpretation that I believe the legislature did not anticipate. I think they anticipated that just be a general sales tax that would be applied. But the Department of Revenue looked at this issue over many, many months, and they looked at a statute called 270C.171. And that statute says that any local tax that's administered by the Department of Revenue has to have the same tax base as the state tax. And so they interpreted that statute as looping in the four or five, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Rochester, and maybe Bewabic. But they interpreted that statute as applying to those state-administered local lodging taxes. And that's how we got to where we have this disparate treatment. I don't think it was a conscious decision by the legislature. I don't think that 270C was even contemplated. But that's how revenue was interpreted, and that's what's in their revenue notice currently.
Questions? Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Innes. As Senator Bach indicated, I think, Mr. Chair, you indicated this is of concern for my Visitors Bureau, for my city as well. And I remember it well from when I was on the council and was on our Visitors Bureau. You know, Mr. Innes, I think you sort of presented a nice, clear case, but my personal experience is more what Senator Wicklund, one of your previous testifiers, said, sir, it depends. And so I wonder if you would just walk me through the back end of your presentation where you said, you know, the hoteliers do cover the local sales, and they do now cover the local sales, but it seems like the local lodging, hotel, motel, it really is. It depends. And that's where you do see a disparity between something that is done online, which I get it's a facilitation, versus something that's done either at the lobby of one of my local hotels or through their own booking system. And I'm just trying to understand, there is a disparity, and I'm not clear on where it's coming from. You know, to me, it seems like it's coming from a booking made online through a third party, and then somehow either the third party or the hotelier is not paying that. And, you know, the estimate I've seen for Duluth, which has a large tourism and a motel industry, you know, is pushing $200,000. So, I mean, that's real money for us. So I'm just wondering if you can help walk me through where it gets lost and who really I should be looking at.
Mr. Innes.
Chairman and Senator Reinhart, I mean, it depends is probably a pretty good answer because there's every online travel company probably has a little different model how they approach this. But, you know, what I can say, Senator, is that the full amount of consideration that's ultimately paid to the hotelier by the customer, local sales taxes are paid on that, the general sales taxes, full amount is paid on that. If it's in a jurisdiction where there's a local lodging tax, it is paid on that, the amount that's remitted to the hotelier. So in my mind, there's no loophole there. I think the question becomes, is it good sound public policy to impose 125 disparate and distinct, because they are disparate. The rates are all different for each one of these potentially different for each one of these local lodging taxes. Even the tax base, 469, allows local jurisdictions to make decisions about what they want to tax within their local lodging tax. So you also have a diverse tax base that you have to deal with. Mm-hmm. But the amount that's remitted to the customer, to the hotel establishment, lodging establishment, all applicable legally owed taxes are paid on that.
Senator Brander.
Mr. Chair, thank you. All true, and I, you know, I appreciate that there is multiple differences around the state, but the legislature has seen fit to permit that. And so the concern I have is if the online folks are not controlling inventory, they're facilitating a transaction, somewhere someone should be paying those 125 different lodging, hotel, motel taxes that the state has seen fit to impose, and they are not in all cases. And so my interest in what Senator Wicklund has brought forward, you know, parochially for my community, is they ought to be, because otherwise it is unfair to the person that's running the establishment in Duluth and booking someone at the door and paying those taxes. So, I mean, to Senator Nelson's earlier comment, I do think there are components of just this online versus bricks and mortar conversation. And I don't know that there's a good person and a bad person in it. I just think that it's, you know, it's part of an evolving economy that where we do a lot of virtual business. And so I'm just interested in, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing this, because I do think there's a conversation to be had here.
Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Anders. You can stay there. Mr. Cummings?
Greetings, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource on this bill. This proposal is in the Department's policy and technical bill package. As stated, in the effective date language, it confirms that local lodging taxes, whether authorized under 469.190 or by special law, were intended to apply to the entire consideration paid to obtain the lodging, including ancillary or related services, such as services provided by accommodation intermediaries, as defined in Minnesota Statutes 297A.61, and similar services. It is consistent with the Department's current interpretation of existing law for local lodging taxes administered by the Department. And Mr. Chair, before I move on, I just wanted to say that local lodging taxes have been around since the inception of the sales tax in 1967. And so if we're going through each of the tax bases related to what a person might pay on lodging, if you look at the general sales tax all across the state, and the room charge is $80, the intermediary, there's a $20 on there, and then the final price that a consumer might see is $100. So let's go through each of the types of taxes that might apply. The state general sales tax at 6.875 would be charged the entire $100. A local sales tax, which there are many across the state, you know, and at various rates and various sizes, and it's very, you know, disparate, that would also apply in these cases. And then finally, to the entire $100, that would be the tax base. For local, for lodging taxes that are administered by the Department of Revenue, it would apply to the $100. But there is a different tax base for the local lodging taxes that are not administered by the Department of Revenue, and that would be at the $80 level. And I don't, I'm not here as an expert in terms of how much, if $80 is the correct amount of money that would be. But there is a difference in the amount of tax base here. So the amount that the consumer pays for a room is not necessarily, for local lodging taxes, is not necessarily the amount that they would be paying in local lodging taxes if it's not administered by the department. And so I think in that case, Senator Wicklund is really trying to create some fairness across the state related to what is tax base. And should there be a difference between the taxes administered by the Department of Revenue and taxes that are not administered by the Department of Revenue?
I would have chosen uniformity.
uniformity. For sales tax purposes, the sales tax chapter was amended in 2011 to explicitly state that sales tax on lodging applies to accommodation intermediary services. It is now clear to accommodation intermediaries, such as online travel companies, that the general sales tax and hence the local sales tax applied to the entire consideration paid for the furnishing of lodging. When the Department of Revenue administers a local lodging tax, currently St. Paul, Minneapolis, Rochester, and Bowabic, whether through 469.190 or as authorized by a special law in conjunction with Minnesota statute, the tax for furnishing lodging is similarly applied to the entire consideration paid to obtain lodging, including ancillary or related services such as services provided by these accommodation intermediaries. This proposal is needed to make it explicit that lodging taxes does not apply to lodging, taxes does apply to lodging-related services, regardless of whether authorized by general or special law, regardless of whether administered by local government or the state. As a policy matter, in determining whether to apply the tax related to lodging-related services, it should not matter who administers the lodging tax, the local government or the Department of Revenue. And it should not matter whether the local lodging tax is authorized by general or special law. To find that the tax is only on lodging related services when administered by the department or explicitly authorized under special law would mean that cities, towns that administer their own lodging taxes, the vast majority of cities and towns, would be unfairly limited to deriving revenues from room charges only rather than to total consideration for lodging services. We think it is a limited and prudent change to the tax code that would bring uniformity and consistency. It would ensure all cities have what consumers see as the sales price taxable for their lodging taxes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. I'm not sure if it would be Mr. Cummings or or Ms. Pollack, but I'm just curious about how we got to the state where we are today. Why is it that I understand special law, but 469, I think, 0.10, you said. Why is it that some, I assume Minneapolis, St. Paul, perhaps, I'm just curious, why are we in a position where some cities have the lodging tax collected by the Department of Revenue and others don't? Other than a special law, you explained that. But what about the rest?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I think that I'm going to ask one of our resources. I think that people can, people can create an agreement with the Department of Revenue in order to collect their local lodging taxes.
Mr. Senator Nelson, I think part of it is if the state does it, they collect an administrative fee. The local government does it, they get to keep it all and they get to control it.
So,
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, another component of that is that the local authority to implement a local lodging tax, and this would be for tourism and promotion of the local jurisdiction, that is under a different section of law than the local sales taxes that we as in the tax committee usually see, which are for general sales tax purposes. They may also be for special sales tax purposes, like it could be a lodging tax or a food and beverage. And those taxes, generally in the authorizing legislation, those special taxes have language saying that the city may elect for the department to collect the tax, and if that is the case, then the department would collect a small administrative fee for doing that. But for these specific lodging taxes under this Chapter 469, there's no such language that would require or state that the department collect the tax.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. And just a follow-up then, is it required? Could additional cities ask the Department of Revenue to administer their lodging tax, or does it require legislation for them to do that?
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, certainly, yes, the local jurisdictions could request that the department collect that local lodging tax.
Thank you.
Mr. Ennis.
Yeah, I mean, Chairman, to Senator Nelson's point, yeah, exactly. 469 is a general law which any city can impose up to 3% lodging tax. If you want to go beyond that as far as a rate, you'd have to come to the legislature and get special legislation. And most, a lot of those special, a handful of special legislation specifically states that the department is going to administer that. But there is a provision, as Ms. Pollack said, in 469 that would allow a local unit of government to say, hey, I want to turn over administration of this tax to the state of Minnesota. The fact that very few communities have gone that route tells me they don't think this is that big an issue, that they like retaining control of the tax, they like administering it themselves, that there isn't a big appetite among the 125 jurisdictions that impose it to have the Department of Administration administer the tax. And I think it's important to bring it back also. You know, we have talked a lot about the online travel companies. I get it. But this would impact a much larger universe of hospitality-related businesses. If anyone wants a low-grain migraine, go ahead and read the revenue notice that the department put out on travel intermediaries. We spent months with the department. They were very patient. But this is what a taxpayer would have to wade through in order to see if they are compliant. Whether it's a tour operator or a small travel agency or a wedding planner, they would have to try to comply with this three-page revenue notice. When they give examples, and they do it, but it is complicated and it is not self-evident. And that's what you would be doing. You'd be imposing 125 of those taxes on a lot of small hospitality-related businesses.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, we think our revenue notice did a pretty good job at doing a plain language read.
Anything else, members? Senator Sengem.
I almost feel like I'm missing something, but I, you know, if I'm the one that buying the hotel room or whatever it might be, you know, I'm, and I get the $80 deal instead of paying the sticker price, so to speak, whatever that might be. You know, I'm happy to pay that lodging tax, I guess, on that $80, but it seems to me we're asking that we pay the taxes on the sticker price as opposed to the actual price of the room. And am I missing something?
Well, Senator Sengem,
I mean, the sticker price can be anything. I mean, go to a car lot, whatever the sticker price is.
I'm not sure it's the sticker price. What I'm trying to do is get the tax collected on what the customer pays. And if it includes the fee, which I think is what we're arguing over, that's so be it. But we need to understand the ramifications. And I think we really, truly need to understand what's happening in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Mohawk so that we can be consistent. And we're either going to change it for them or change it for everybody else, but I think it should be consistent.
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Senator Sengem.
I'm trying to understand. You know, okay, $80 for the room, $20 for the Travelocity, whoever it is, but do I pay a fee to Travelocity as well, or does a hotel?
If you, Senator Sengem, I think if you book it online, you do. But if you go walk in the door of the hotel, then you would not. And okay. To the point that maybe Senator Reinhart brought up about the kiosk when we were doing the sales tax debate, that you could have this differential. If you bought it at the kiosk, you would not. But if you walked over to the desk, you would. Those are the kind of things I think we need to try to avoid.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, there is a travel. There isn't a Travelocity fee. There isn't. So it's not a separately stated charge on a bill. It is something that is within the sales price for the furnishing of the room. So the sales price that the person would see is $100. There is never a time in which the person would see the $80 on a receipt. They would just see the $100. So we're saying that tax base should be consistent regardless of which tax is being applied.
Members, we have one more comment. Mr. Cummings, could you step back for a second, please?
Of course.
Mr. Rudling, and then, members, if you're done with questions, we're going to wrap this up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be brief. Just to clarify, this... The customer will go to a website or walk in the door and it matters which website you go to, how much tax you pay. So if you go to an OTC website, you're going to pay $100 for the room and then tax on a lesser amount. And so what Mr. Ines said was that taxes were paid on the amount that's paid to the hotel. That $80 goes to the hotel and $20 goes to the OTC in this example. And so what we're saying is it shouldn't matter which website you go to. If you go to Marriott's website or if you go to Travelocity, how much tax you pay. And right now that is the case. And there is a discussion happening right now about what the tax base is in Minneapolis when the DOR collects that came up in the House Tax Committee, and I won't replay that. But simply leveling the playing field may not do it. And that's why the DE3 amendment on the House side and this A2 amendment clarifies those two issues, that no matter who collects, it's the whole consideration that the customer sees. It's not the $80, it's the $100 that the customer sees. All this happens behind the scenes, and the customer is not aware of how much the OTC gets and how much the hotel gets and that type of thing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson, and then we're going to wrap this up after Senator Wicklund. Yep.
I just have one clarifying question in trying to understand this. So when the hotel who owns the rooms sells them to the intermediary, the sales tax is paid because the room has been sold to the intermediary, into the OTC. But then the OTC resells the room to a customer. And so if we were to adopt this language, would we be saying that the resale of objects is then also liable for taxation? I think usually when there's a resale of objects, the tax is paid on the original transaction. So this seems like it's taking this a different track.
It's a lodging tax, Senator yep. Nelson. I don't know that. Ms. Pollack, do you want to help on this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, again, with the example of the accommodation intermediary purchasing a room for then later resale on the OTC's website, the tax is imposed at the end final use. So it would not be paid at two points in the transaction. And I think Mr. Rudlang and Mr. Ines wanted to talk on that.
Maybe, Chairman, just real quick.
Mr. Ines.
I probably shouldn't be arguing against Senator Nelson on this because it sounds like she has concerns about this legislation. But I want to make it clear that the online travel companies do not buy hotel blocks of hotel rooms from the hotels. They do not. That's a common myth that it's been perpetuated by people who want to pass these tax increases, but that is not how our business model works. We do not control the inventory. We do not buy and resell rooms. We are a facilitator of a transaction. So the courts have consistently said you are not an accommodations provider. That's not what you guys do. You guys are not in that business, and these taxes should not apply. Having said that, the full consideration, to Senator Sanjum's point, the full consideration that's paid to the hotel, all applicable local and state taxes are paid. So whatever goes on Senator Sanjum's credit card when he checks into that hotel, the tax is being paid in full.
Anything else, Senator Wicklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've had a good discussion, and I would just like to reinforce that I believe it's a matter of consistency, and I believe that while it appears that there's a difference of opinion of who is paying what at what time, but I think it is a matter of consistency. Customers do not have the visibility into the breakdown, and the cities that are collecting the lodging tax should be gaining that lodging tax on the full consideration that a customer is paying. And so I request that you consider that.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, thank you for the conversation. Thank you very much. Chair, we'll lay over Senate File 1066 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Dames. When we get done with testimony, or we can just leave David till the end. Senator Dame, Senate File 1130, Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And Senate File 1130 is a bill that relates to the Marshall Local Sales Tax and Use Tax Imposition Prior Act validation. And in order to save time, I have two testifiers here, Mr. John Utley, the attorney for the City of Marshall, and Mr. Ben Martag, administrator for the City of Marshall. And if it's with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Utley to give a little description of why this bill is important.
Welcome, Mr. Utley. State your name for the record, please.
My name is John Utley. I'm an attorney with Kennedy and Graven. We act as special counsel to the City of Marshall on a number of matters, including its local sales and use tax.
Continue.
This bill, as Senator stated, relates to the local sales and use tax that was adopted by the legislature in 2011. The bill, after adopted, was approved by the City Council. It went to a referendum and was approved by the citizens in a general election. The City Council then adopted an ordinance imposing the tax. The problem has developed because in doing a due diligence review of the materials related to this tax over the years, we discovered that although the city has approved the legislation as required by state law, and in fact filed that with the Secretary of State as also required, we were unable to confirm that that filing occurred on a timely basis. And as a result, we're asking that this bill be adopted that would cure that problem, that the filing that has occurred would be deemed timely filed.
And how, Mr. Utley, how late was the filing, and is there what was the reason for the late filing again?
It's Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's difficult in looking through the documentation as to exactly why the filing didn't occur on a timely basis. It was the documentation shows that the parties were aware of it. City Council authorized it to be filed, and it seems like everything was done right up to the point when it should have been filed. And the only thing we can think is that there was a misunderstanding among the parties and council as to who was to do that filing. And as a result, it appears that it was not done. We can't find evidence that it was done, although, again, quite a bit was done right up to the moment when it should have been, and we just don't have that. Again, it was later done in conjunction with the filing with subsequent legislation, and that was timely filed with the Secretary of State. It's just that this particular bill appears to not have been filed in a timely manner.
Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Martin, City Administrator for Marshall. I might be able to help with that a little bit, too. The filing was due in June of 2012. We filed it in June of 2013 with our other taxes that we had in conjunction with these. I think where some of the confusion happened on staff's part related to the state requirement for a local election, which occurred that November. And so we were under the assumption that we had to have the election before the filings could be done on that. So I think there was a little miscommunication there. We actually did a technical correction on one of the taxes last year where we thought that was getting resolved with that, but it wasn't done with that. So I guess just a general statement that I'm sorry that we're here to have the legislature dealing with this again. It would certainly be helpful for us to wrap up our file. The taxes are being collected. We've issued bonds, so we have obligations to bondholders. The two capital projects we're building, from the good news, we got state bonding for both of the projects, and we are under construction now with the early spring. So I think they're good projects. It's moving along, so it's really kind of an administrative function. Should be the last time we're here before you related to this project for quite some time. So no more filings will be required if we get this action, so we'd greatly appreciate your support. And, again, unfortunate that we're here before you to ask for the correction. Thank you.
Questions, members? Anything else, Senator Dames? Anyone in the audience wish to testify in opposition to Senate File 1130? Seeing none, anything else, Senator Dames?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for hearing Senate File 1130, and I hope that this can be included in your omnibus tax bill so that we can move this forward. And as City Administrator Martig said, then hopefully we won't be back on this issue again. Thank you.
Sir, and members, it was about a six-month late filing. Hopefully this is the first and last time. Thank you, Senator Dames. Chair, I'll lay Senate File 1130 over for possible inclusion. Senator Tomsoni.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. And
Senator Tomsoni, good luck explaining this one.
Maybe I won't, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I'll have Mr. Agaro explain it. Mr. Chairman, this is really not that easy to explain if you want to know the truth. And it's Senate File 656, and it refers to some controversy between the tax identification numbers of not only houses but the property that they're on, and in often cases it causes the county some problems in who's responsible for the property tax on both the houses and the property. And then I think some of this property went tax forfeit, and then the underlying value of the land and the property and the value of the property above the land had different owners, and so who ends up actually being responsible for the property is, for both properties, is a problem for the county because of different tax identification numbers. So I think that's what this is trying to straighten out, and so maybe Mr. Ongaro can explain it a little bit better.
And Mr. Ongaro.
Mr. Chair and members, John Ongaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. As Senator Tomsoni explained, we had a problem with the parcel identification numbers assigned to these properties. You had a situation where the underlying property owner had a legal parcel identification number, and the structures, the lessees on that property, were assigned another parcel identification number mistakenly by the county. The reason the county did that was to try to facilitate so those property for the people that lived in the structures on the property were given were eligible to receive a homestead credit, and that was a mistake. The county should not have done that. So now we're in a situation where a number of these properties, mainly it's mining companies that own the underlying property, they have given notice to the lessees that they have to vacate the property. That notice in some instances was given 10 years ago, and it is just taking effect now. So a lot of the people that own the structures on the property basically have walked away from those properties, knowing that they weren't going to be able to continue to live there, so they quit paying the property taxes, and now we're in the process of forfeiture delinquency or outright forfeiture. So in order to fix the situation, the county is proposing to essentially cancel the forfeiture and go reset the entire situation so that the actual properties are the tax liability for the underlying property owner would no longer be there, so that the cancellation of the tax forfeiture would occur, and then we would combine the underlying property and the surface structure on that property with one single parcel identification number, and that would remedy the situation. And quite frankly, because the tax forfeited statute does not contemplate a situation like we're facing right now, we think actually it flies in the face of the current tax forfeited statute, because the county cannot use, develop, or sell the underlying land. And that certainly in direct conflict with what the intent of the tax forfeited statute is. So we feel that this is an acceptable remedy for everybody. And again, the underlying property owner will not get stuck with the back taxes that are owed on the surface for those surface structures.
And Mr. Ungaro, so a number of years ago, perhaps decades ago, the county split the parcels. So you had two separate pins, one for the buildings and one for the land, and then charged real property on the buildings so they could get a homestead break. Correct. When you probably, or you should have been charging personal property because they had real property at that point. So we've had this ongoing error, and now we're to the point where the mining companies want to mine the land, so the buildings are worthless, and the cost of demolition is the issue that we're debating?
Mr. Chair, Ungaro. Certainly that is an issue, I believe, that the underlying property owners do not want to be responsible for dealing with the removal of those buildings. However, they've had long-term leases with the people who own the structures on that property. They've been receiving annual payments, et cetera, for the cost of them leasing their land. So we just don't feel it is an appropriate use of the tax forfeited trust to expend dollars on what is someone else's responsibility. I mean, technically, we can't even set foot on that land to deal with those structures. We would be trespassing on someone else's land. So it is diametrically opposed to what the intent of the tax forfeited statute is all about.
And Mr. Ungaro, the question that occurs is if they had been taxed as personal property like they should have been, they wouldn't be in forfeiture. So the forfeiture statutes wouldn't be applying.
Correct. So it was a mistake. Clearly, the county made a mistake, and we're trying to remedy that mistake here for the best interests of all the parties involved.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hennepin County, and I was looking to see if they were here, has a similar situation. It's a little different. And so I think this, you know, just may be an issue moving forward that others have. It's in Hennepin County, they didn't have separate identification numbers, but they have some of the buildings that have now gone tax forfeit and are dilapidated have either a billboard or a cell tower on top of them. And so the county is trying to figure out, and they've had leases, and the owners of the billboard or the cell tower have been paying the leases, but the, you know, the person who owned the building just quit paying the taxes, so it's gone tax forfeit. And so they're having this quandary of you've got a legitimate business that has, you know, stuff on top of a structure that's about ready to collapse. And so they're having kind of a similar conversation on just how do we deal with, you know, some of these tax forfeit issues. So
Senator Rest.
Not quite the same.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Tomasoni, I'm trying to figure out if we do nothing here, if we didn't do this, the result would be, and is this correct? The result would be the properties would have to, the structures would have to be removed, and if it's about 30 of them, it would be a cost of $300,000 to the county. Is that correct? If you did nothing, that's what would happen? Or if we did nothing, would the county be in some sort of litigation with the mining company over the issue, which I'm assuming they currently are not? They're just trying to figure out what to do. If we did nothing in this bill, is that what would happen? A $300,000 hit to the county to remove the structures at the company's request. And then, of course, my next question is, if we do this and correct this mistake, then who pays? to get the properties, the structures removed, either Mr. Ungaro or Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Coyle, why don't you join us at the table? Mr. Ungaro.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. Right now in the pipeline, there are 30 properties that this pertains to. The universe, however, is approximately 106 parcels that will be impacted by this. So
over $1 million, Mr.
Over $1 million, potentially.
Mr. Ungaro.
Each one is going to be different. So, again, it goes back to this is not what we believe anyways, the tax forfeited land statute was intended for. The the county has no way to legitimately even go onto this property. These are structures that received an annual payment from the lessees to the underlying property owners, and that should be their responsibility, not the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ungaro, I think what you're telling me is that this matter would go to court about whose responsibility it was, and the county has one position and the mining company has another, but the cost of removal of these structures would, let's say there was litigation and the county lost, it would be a hit of over $1 million to the St. Louis County taxpayers.
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, approximately.
Okay, right. All right. I just want to make sure I understand that. And then if this bill
– Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we pass this and I actually am sympathetic to what the county did to start with. I mean, a mistake, but seemed to make as we often say, seemed like a good idea at the time, right? If we pass this, then what? What's the result then? Is there still going to be the possibility of litigation over what we do or under what we do? Or is there a bright line result here that removes the obligation of the county to clear the structures from the land?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest,
Mr. Ungaro,
I do believe that the remedy that is in this legislation will allow us to, as I stated previously, basically do a reset on this and start over from square one. We will not hold the underlying property owners for the tax liability that is owed overall on those properties, and so they won't inherit the tax liability from the structures that they will be inheriting now. And so we think that's the fair thing to do for now, and that's a win for the underlying property owners, and then we move forward just as we should.
Senator Rest.
So, Mr. Chairman, so the evening out is there would be property taxes due on the structures for whatever amount. They get relieved from that liability, and the county gets relieved from any responsibility of what the mining company does with the structures. I mean, it's irrelevant to you. I mean, they can do anything they want, tear them down, build them up, whatever, but they're not but the trade is they don't pay any taxes on them, and the county is not responsible for anything that happens to the structures. That's what this bill would do. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I agree with you, but as far as the county not being responsible for anything to deal with those structures, I didn't quite understand your last point.
Senator Rest.
Well, that you would not have they get relief from the property taxes, and the county has no responsibility toward whether the structures on the no financial responsibility for removing the
Correct.
Property. Correct. So the trade is the county doesn't pay to tear them down, and the mining company doesn't have to pay property taxes on.
Right, the back
with this, that's the remedy that's in this legislation.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Coyle.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Tomasoni. I represent Winona Properties, which is an investment group that owns the underlying real estate. It's not a mining company. It's a real estate investment group. No problem. I hesitate to testify against Senator Tomasoni's bill because he's a great advocate for his county, but I must. My client purchased this property 10 years ago. As a condition of the purchase, it was required to terminate these leases that are the subject of this forfeiture proceeding. And so we cannot use these structures going forward, even if they are reverted back to us by statute. Secondly, we never owned the residences in the first instance. They were never our property. And as the county has been forthright in acknowledging, there is a substantial cost associated with removing these tax forfeit residences. And respectfully, we feel like it would be unfair to shift this cost burden back to the landowner, who has no responsibility for them being in tax forfeit situation. So that's our testimony.
And Mr. Coyle, what's going to be the use of the land eventually?
It is mineable property in some future year. But that's not presently the case.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Much of what I was going to ask has been answered, but on line 1.19, why do we have the county may without approval? Why do we have without approval rather than with approval? I just want some clarification on that.
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, I believe that the reason for that is because of the powers and duties entrusted to a county auditor. That's why that is written that way, but clearly this is the county auditor's responsibility to deal with the tax forfeited land in St. Louis County or in any county. So that is the primary reason for that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I support this anyway, but I think because it's already pretty volatile, I think it should be just the opposite. It should be with, mm-hmm. so we have more people involved in making that decision.
Senator Gazelka moves an oral amendment on page 1, line 19, strike without and insert with. Any conversation? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
You want that to be and as well.
No. Amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thinking about the dual pins, is there anything in this legislation that would prevent this from happening again? It seems like there was maybe a financial incentive for some to have the dual pins between the, or to have the properties not taxed properly. And I'm not exactly sure who that financial incentive went to, but my question is, in the future, is there anything that would prevent this type of misclassification going forward? Or would this legislation make it easier to have dual pins in the future?
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
And Senator Nelson, essentially the way the property tax system is supposed to work is that there is only one parcel identification number assigned, a legal parcel identification number, and that is because the formal legal description that goes with a property deals with both the underlying property and the surface mm-hmm. property, and that's what we're trying to do here is to fix this situation so that legally it is, you know, one parcel identification number, not two. There's only one true legal parcel identification number, and that is the underlying property, because that is the legal description and it's recorded in the county recorder's office, et cetera. Structure on there, no such situation exists.
Senator Nelson.
And did you see how long this had been going on with these kind of two pins for the same property?
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, too long is my short answer, but several decades. And although Winona Properties just purchased some of this 10 years ago, the parent company prior to that was USX, US Steel, which you know had this for decades and decades. They owned these lands. And I can't say that it is just mining company property. There are a few other properties too that are not that are owned by non-mining companies. So it's really somewhat of a smorgasbord. But all in all, the vast majority of these parcels are owned by mining companies.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Nelson.
Well, I'd like someone to kind of walk through this with me, because I don't think the mining companies do pay property tax. And so what was the tax, what was the change in tax liability to the state because of the decades of, you know, dual pins instead of accurately taxing this? Was it less funding to the state and how much, or did it result in more production tax or less production tax? I'm just How did that all work out? Why did we get in this situation? There was a reason why there was a different interpretation, one would say, why there was different taxation. And I'm just trying to nail down why that was and what was the effect of that, and then how do we make sure it doesn't happen again?
Mr. Ungaro.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, although the legislators from the Iron Range especially like to remind you that the taconite production tax is in lieu of property taxes. Yes, they are very correct in that, but that doesn't mean that mining companies don't pay some property taxes on other,
right,
other lands that they own which aren't actively being mined, and that's the instance here. So This pertains to those other lands that they own, and clearly in this case the mining companies felt that there was an opportunity to derive some revenue off those lands that were sitting away from their main mining locations. And so they've been, over the decades, probably for close to the last 100 years, have been doing the same thing, leasing property so people could live there or recreate there or whatever. And so when the homestead credit program came along, that's when this problem developed. The county felt that it was an opportunity to allow the individuals living on these lands to also receive a lower property tax bill via the homestead credit. And that's when the problem began, and this helps correct that problem, and that's why this bill is here.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Thompson.
Senator Nelson, here's what happened in many instances on the Iron Range as the mining was developing. There were all kinds of places called locations, and locations were built by the mining companies for the miners themselves, and they were houses that were on these locations that were near the mining site. And basically speaking, it was a convenience thing for not only the miners but the mining companies to have these people located close to the mine, so they would have a house to live in, and then they could just walk out of the house and go down into the mine. And in most instances, what happened with the locations was the mining company started mining where the location was, so they had to move the homes. And so oftentimes the miner was able to buy the house for a buck and move it into the town. And then they would mine that location. I think what probably happened here in Sparta, because this is where it is, it's just outside of Gilbert, is that they never mined this location, so they turned the homes over to people. And I would think that the property underneath had a tax identification number on it, and at some point in time they decided when they turned the house over to the person that house should have a property identification number. And at that point, then the problem started happening. So I think that's probably what happened here, too.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So who received the homestead credit? If the land was owned by the mines and the property tax was, or in this case, property tax would have been paid because it wasn't being mined, so it was, there was no production tax. Who did the homestead tax credit go to if the homeowners did not own the land because they were tenants?
Mr. Angaro.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, as I understand, it went to the owner of the structure via the personal property tax bill that they did have to pay.
Thank you.
Mr. Coyle. You were aware of this, the landowners, when they purchased the land. In my mind, if the USX had continued to own this, I would have found this easier resolution. But being that there's a new landowner there, what's the status of the negotiations with the mines on the mining of the parcel that they bought? Has that been completed or is that ongoing?
Ongoing.
Ongoing. Okay, well, that's helpful a little bit. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I might have just missed your question. I had a similar question on, you know, did the lease address this issue? Did it address the, conditions of the, who paid for maintenance and the condition of the buildings? And did it address any of the, and I know you just bought the properties of, you know, what would happen if the property owner stopped paying the taxes and it went forfeit? You said you purchased this about 10 years ago, so, and you terminated the leases, but did the, were the people in the building still paying some type of lease payment over the last 10 years? And then, you know, did you purchase all the properties and what do the other owners think should happen? And then, you know, I think Mr. Angaro presented, or Senator Rez presented, kind of a trade-off to some degree. Do you have another solution? I mean, I understand that tearing down buildings is $17,000 to $25,000 in the metro area, and so it is, costly. But do you have another solution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, just to be clear, the situation that Mr. Angaro and Senator Tomasoni are trying to address in our instance and my client's instance affects seven properties, not the entirety of the residences that are in question here. So I just demarcate that, but nonetheless, the problem is still there. There have been conversations back and forth between my client and the county about what to do, but it's fundamentally about the money, right? It's the cost of the demolition. I can't speak at all to the underlying lease situation. I presume rents were being paid to the landowner by the resident occupants while they were occupying, but as I said earlier, as a condition of the purchase of the land, we were required to terminate those leases. So, I mean, our interest at that point basically terminated. So I just be clear about that.
Mr. Angaro, how many landowners are there involved in this?
Mr. Chair, I've been told that the universe is 106 parcels, whether that means 106
could we
different
get
landowners.
That
I don't believe so. I believe the list I saw was less than 20.
Could we get that list, please?
Yes.
Senator Dietzick.
And then I don't need it now, but it would be good to, again, as we kind of figure out the trade-off, what were the, I'm assuming some of these back taxes have been accruing over, maybe even as long as 10 years. So if you have an estimate of how much is owed, I know they can add up pretty quickly and the numbers can get pretty high, especially if there's fees assessed with it.
Mr. Angaro, I think what we're asking for is some give us the realm of the financial implications of what we're doing. What are the back taxes? What are the values? What are the costs of demolition and who the owners are? That'd be helpful, Senator Dietzick.
And ultimately,
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, ultimately, the property owners have the mineral rights, and if the properties are ever mined, they will be making a lot of money on them. So there's a pretty good trade-off for the owners.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, why isn't the Board of Equalization been involved here?
Mr. Angaro.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I'm not sure why they would necessarily be involved other than certainly if one of those individuals who own the who have a surface structure were to have appealed the situation, clearly the Board of Equalization could have gotten involved. But I think because they were given a notice that they had to vacate their land within 10 years, a lot of these people just walked away. I mean, they certainly quit paying their property taxes, period. And many of them probably still are utilizing that land, but there was no incentive for them to continue paying their property taxes if they knew they were going to be removed from the land.
Mr. Chair, well, I think what you've proposed is an extreme remedy. I mean, it doesn't mean it doesn't need a fix, but it's a very extreme remedy, and I'm concerned that there aren't enough checks in the system, and so I think we should change line 1.19 again, Senator Tomasoni, and change the word or to and, so that both the county board approves and the commissioner of revenue has been informed and approves as well. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that on line 1.19 we change the word or to and.
Senator Ortman, you and Mr. Sylvie are thinking along the same lines.
Go ahead.
Conversation, Senator Tomasoni?
I think that's...
Senator Ortman moves on page 1, line 19, strike or, insert and. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify in opposition to Senate file number 656? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Chair will lay Senate File 656 as amended over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Rest. Members, we're going to run a little long today, it looks like. Session isn't till noon, but it just unless we move along a little faster, we're going to be here a while. So. Senator Rest. Which one first? Senate File 269.
I'll do 269. Senate File 269 is a proposal to treat the that's imposed on gas that generally is used in cars that is increasingly being used in usually private aircraft, which previously at 28.5%, since it is a non-road use, 23.5% has been subject to a refund to the purchasers. Generally, obviously, this fuel is purchased on airport land, and then the other 5 cents goes into the state airport fund. And the proposal is just to set aside the refund mechanism and just impose the 5 cents tax on that fuel and put it into the state airports fund without going through the refund application. In the future, I think within the next couple of years, there is going to be increasing amount of gasoline currently used mostly in cars, approval for use in small aircraft, and so we're trying to get ahead of that curve with regard to getting those dollars into the state airports fund at that nickel. And that's the change that's proposed, and I don't know of any opposition.
And Senator Rest, the airport fund been pretty stable in the past?
Since, Mr. Chairman, since the legislature has stopped rating it. Yes.
Any questions, members? Members, I do have at some point an amendment that I'm going to be offering to this, or we're going to be incorporating dealing with airplanes that don't use airports that still buy fuel and pay tax, and giving them some relief from this provision. We didn't have time to get it ready, but I have
and
had
Mr. Chairman,
with Senator Wilson.
I'm open to that and would be happy to include it with regard to those uses. People that use private airstrips for private business, that's not as long as we can figure out a way that creates a paper trail.
Yes.
That they also would be included, because it is gas that's purchased for non-road use, and be in that same category.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we mentioned this in transportation, but just so tax committee members know as well, and this, we're getting ahead of an issue here. Most general aviation aircraft is still operating on low lead fuel, and that's going to go away, and they're going to operate on what we would consider car gas. And so by doing this, we get ahead of that issue.
And Senator Rest, Ms. Pollack tells me there's an oral technical amendment needed.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if she would let us know what that is, and I would offer it for the committee's consideration.
Ms. Pollack, can you explain Senator Rest's technical amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment is to, on page 2, just make clear that the references to gasoline in all of those sections there are for gasoline used as a substitute for aviation gasoline. So on lines 2.14 and 2.19, after the new language gasoline, insert used as a substitute for aviation gasoline.
Any questions?
One more,
Ms.
Mr.
Pollack.
Chair. And then on page 3, the language on the new language on 3.14 and 3.15 is not necessary, because those reporting requirements are required in the paragraph above. So the amendment would be to strike the new language on 3.14 and 3.15.
Senator,
I'm sorry, delete the new language on 3.14 and 3.15.
Senator Rest moves the oral amendment as read by Ms. Pollack. Questions, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendments adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Rest.
That's
Mr.
it.
Hoff?
We don't need to say anything. We're good.
Thank you. Anyone wish to testify in opposition to Senate File 269 as amended? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Rest. Chair will lay Senate File 269 as amended over for possible inclusion. Senator Rest, Senate File 983.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 983 deals with compressed natural gas, which is a trending toward an extremely popular fuel and particularly used by waste haulers. And this bill comes with support from both the administration and the affected industry to have a more uniform treatment of the purchase of this gas with regard to the tax rate and on what volumes and so forth. So it does change the excise tax rate, and we think that it is it simplifies, streamlines, and brings the tax rate more into on a competitive basis, or an equal basis, equitable basis maybe is a better word, with the tax on car gas.
Senator
and
Rest.
I do have an amendment. I have the A2 amendment. This is not an author's amendment, so I would offer it and then explain it.
Senator Rest moves the A2 author's amendment. Questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A2 is adopted.
And, Mr. Chairman, that amendment did just, again,
reflect the administration's position and is supported by the industry. And I do have a couple of testifiers just to speak briefly about the creating this level playing field with between the compressed natural gas and diesel and regular gasoline and maybe just a little bit about how that came to be, but there's no opposition to, as I have been informed, there's no opposition to the proposal at this point as amended.
And Senator Resta's members, as I understand this, we're bringing this liquefied natural gas, compressed natural gas, in line with what the industry standard is. And so it's a federal
conformity issue, yes, as well as an equitable tax, so that there's this level playing field, so that it doesn't cost more to do what the industry as well as the administration assumes is a more eco-friendly fuel.
Mr. Carnival.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, McGranche Carnival Law Firm, representing the Minnesota chapter of the National Waste and Recycling Association. The waste and recycling industry has more heavy-duty compressed natural gas trucks than any other industry in the United States, excluding buses. Our industry has been a leader in the purchase of natural gas trucks and the installation of CNG fueling stations, and is the fastest-growing segment among heavy-duty trucks. Our members in Minnesota have 174 trucks and 6 fueling stations located here in the metropolitan area. Our members in Minnesota, the hub-and-spoke nature of waste and recycling collection vehicles works well with our trucks returning to their home base at night and being able to refuel before the next day's operations. CNG trucks are expensive. A typical recycling truck costs about $300,000, and a CNG truck can cost as much as $30,000 more. A typical fueling station, depending on existing site retrofits and maintenance bays, can cost anywhere from $2 million to $4 million. Additional expenses are incurred while training mechanics and drivers so that they have expertise to work on and drive these vehicles. Despite these examples, these trucks are easier to maintain and quieter and cleaner. For example, greenhouse gas emissions are reduced by 21% over standard diesel engines, and if the CNG gas is derived from landfill gas versus standard pipeline CNG, the greenhouse gases can be reduced by an astounding 90%. Yet the CNG tax rate is higher than the gasoline gallon equivalent and the diesel gallon equivalent. Our industry supports this legislation because it removes the CNG penalty and eliminates market distortion that favors diesel. This legislation will provide a level playing field with regard to fuel taxation. This bill makes environmental sense, and we appreciate the bipartisan support to remove this impediment to that change and advance implementation of this renewable fuel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource on this bill. First, Mr. Chair, I wanted to state that Governor Dayton and the Department of Revenue support Senator Rest's bill. And with that, we wanted to thank Senator Rest for bringing forward this important correction to our tax code. Our tax statutes have overestimated the energy content of CNG and therefore have been taxing CNG users higher if you look at similar energy contents in fuels, although the tax has been applied according to law. Current Minnesota law provides that the British thermal unit BTU content for CNG at 1,000 BTUs for cubic foot. The IRS and industry standard is 900 BTUs for cubic foot. The IRS and IFTA, which is the International Fuel Tax Agreement, use the conversion factor of 26.67 cubic feet of CNG for every 1 gallon of gasoline. Current Minnesota law uses a conversion factor of 114.9 cubic feet of CNG for every 1 gallon of gasoline. Consistency with IRS and IFTA will make filing tax returns consistent and easier for members of the industry by eliminating the need to use two different conversion factors, one in Minnesota and one elsewhere. The changes proposed would eliminate our need of maintaining a separate conversion tables and rates compared to the IRS and IFTA, and would provide a small amount of tax relief. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation on this.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would direct members' attention to the revenue estimate. There is a small cost to the Highway User Fund.
Any questions, members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify in opposition to Senate File 983 as amended?
Sure.
Seeing none, thank you, Senator Rest. Chair will lay Senate File number 983 as amended over for possible inclusion. Senator Dietzick. Senator Dietzick, Senate File 2099.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 2099. In 2013, the legislature made changes to the other tobacco product taxation, including moist snuff. The tax was changed to the rate of 95% of the wholesale price of tobacco products, or a minimum tax equal to the rate of the tax imposed on a pack of 20 cigarettes weighing not more than 3 pounds per thousand on each container of moist snuff. There was some confusion about what is a container. Is it just the smallest can size? This bill clarifies the meaning of container, clarifies how to determine the tax, and that the tax on moist snuff is always the greater of the two calculations. I have a delete all amendment. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson?
We don't seem to have a fiscal note on this or a council research on this bill, at least in our packets here.
Mr. Chair, I believe they're supposed to be passing
Senator
them
Dietzick.
Out. I believe they're passing them out.
Thank you.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and members, the author's A2 amendment is being passed out, and the summary is drafted to the amendment. Senator Dietzick or Ms. McQuay may be able to speak to the revenue estimate.
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, the revenue estimate was drawn to a previous amendment, and I did have revenue look at the amendment, and they just got back to me that they did not believe it would change, so that could be passed out, and we could just I just offer to the committee that, you know, upon further looking into this by the Department of Revenue, that it may change, but at first glance we can work off the A1,
and so we'll get that passed out also. Senator Dietzick has the A2 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Senator Dietzick, is the bill in the form that you would like?
It is for now. Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Anything else, Senator Dietzick?
No, I gave a quick summary of the bill. We've tweaked it along. I've reached out to different entities. I've heard from some, haven't yet heard from others. I know there are people from the Department of Revenue here. If you have specific questions for them, that's all
questions,
I have for now.
Questions, members? Anyone wish to testify on Senate File 2099 as amended with the delete all amendment? I'll give you a few minutes to get the amendment. Mr. Cummings, does the department have thoughts on this? No? Well, he's coming up. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. It'll give people a chance to read the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First, I just wanted to thank Senator Dietzick for kind of looking at a problem mid-session and trying to come up with a solution that would work. There is a new type of product coming onto the market, these tubs, and Senator Dietzick has really taken a really sort of a laser-focused approach to try and solve that. I think that the amendment does a very good job, but we would continue to like to work with the committee and Senator Dietzick as we review the language just to make sure it works. But this is a fix, and we do appreciate Senator Dietzick working on this.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is probably for staff. I apologize. I missed the beginning of this. I was trying to help them get a quorum down in State Gov, so I ran down – or up in State Gov, I should say. As I see this, we're essentially adding a potential tax for containers over 1.2 ounces, but we're not taking away any taxes, again, unless I missed something. So how is it possible that the revenue projection doesn't change? How is that possible?
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, the original amendment that the revenue estimate was drafted to looked very similar to the bill that you see in front of, or the amendment that you see in front of you, the A2. Doing the math, it sort of all looks the same, but when you take a more closer look at it, you could find more inconsistencies on how it's applied. So between the A1 and the A2, I did the math the same, but you may be able to find a little more flexibility in the language when applying it. And so at first glance, we think the math is the same and the revenue estimate wouldn't change from the A1, which I don't think is in front of the committee, and the A2, but it may.
And Senator Thompson, we understand that this time of year with multiple committee meetings, we're kind of stretched a little bit. Just briefly, what it appears to me is going on, the difference between current law and the delete everything amendment, is that there are these very large containers of moist snuff being marketed, and they're paying the same tax as the small containers. And Senator Dietzick's initiative is to try to have a comparable tax burden irrespective of the size of, I mean, make the tax the same, not the size of the container.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I know we're all busy. Anything else, members? Anyone wish to testify on Senate File 299? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair will lay Senate File 2099 as amended over for possible inclusion. And is Senator Cohen here?
He's coming down.
Coming down.
I know.
She deals with a tub. So when you divide everything up in one place, it's all divided.
I'll quick sign on if you want, Mr. Chair.
Sarah Ryder.
I said I'll quick sign on if you want, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
See, there's no co-op.
He's supposed to be real close, so we'll give it a minute. Who are they? Mm-hmm. Well, you want to wait for the bill author.
Yeah,
I've
got three.
Oh, I don't want to start without the author. Welcome, Senator Cohen, Senate File 2074.
Chairman, members, I think I just was told to come down right now from finance, so I apologize. You've been waiting for a couple minutes. I have a couple of people here to testify, I believe.
Yeah, they're here.
Oh, why don't you come up to the...
Senator Cohen, I didn't want to start without the author here, so I didn't bring them up, but if Ms. Johansson, Ms. Hartley, and Mr. Steele wish to join you at the table.
So, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 2074 is allows for a 25% tax credit for qualifying expenditures for the Minnesota Film and Television Board. Let me just offer a couple of introductory comments. I've been involved with the Film Board since its inception back when I was a House member. And clearly for the state of Minnesota, it's a little bit of a unique economic development tool, but one that's been of significant success in the past. We've dealt with this in fits and starts, but I've, in chairing, not the Finance Committee, but previously in chairing the State Government Finance Division when the division had jurisdiction over all the economic development programs, took a look at what we do in terms of economic development. And the problem we have with a lot of the economic development monies we spend is that there's either a one-time expenditure for hiring, and then the economic development return to the state goes away, or it takes quite a few years to incubate. The advantage to film production in Minnesota is that there's an immediacy, and that's because of several things. One, you have a significant secondary acting pool that doesn't exist elsewhere. Second, you have, at least in the past, a crew availability that doesn't exist elsewhere. Three, you have an accessibility that doesn't exist elsewhere, where you can come into the Twin Cities and in 20, 30 minutes you're in farm country, rural country, or in lake country. You also have, even to what's become a very developing and significant production base in the northeastern part of the state, you have significant access to the Twin Cities. So if you want a wilderness kind of setting, you have that fairly accessible and available Minnesota, whereas if you're doing something in the northern part of the state of Idaho, you don't have access to a major metropolitan area. So you have a variety of things here that would allow for the building up of a very significant production base within an immediacy and a synergy that if you go back to kind of the heyday of film production in Minnesota in the 90s, where there was a significant production community that had developed. Minnesota had become, I think, something like the fourth or fifth largest production center in the country with a return on investment that was huge and immediate in comparison to a lot of the other economic development monies that are spent. Just a couple of other comments. What's happened is that the latter part of the 90s, the Canadian exchange rate became much more favorable, and as a consequence, a lot of production went to Canada from the United States. Second, states ended up in deficit. And so Minnesota had deficits like everybody else, and so a lot of this work dried up because of the combination. What did develop then over the last decade or so was the use of film incentives. Minnesota actually had the first incentive, which was a very small one. Now other states have gotten into this in a way that Minnesota, again, with all the advantages we ought to have, cannot take advantage of them. The hope is, which began 2 years ago, was that if we were able to provide a reasonable, moderate incentive, we'd be able to take advantage of what are a lot of our natural advantages and create an industry here that, again, would be immediate with a permanency of arguably several thousand full-time jobs, but there needs to be the state support. And, in fact, there's a recent legislative auditor's report, and if you read through the report carefully, the consistency of criticism is that Minnesota has not really done this in an effective, ongoing way. And that's prevented Minnesota from taking advantage of where we were in the 1990s. The last comment I would make, and then would ask Ms. Johansson to talk about the credit directly. Last comment I would make is that we're not talking simply of at this juncture, just simply the production of the biggest movie in the world, but the combination of film production, independent film production, commercial production, documentary production, television production. And the film board right now, with the start as a consequence of what we did 2 years ago, keep in mind there's some incubation that's needed. It doesn't just happen overnight. But once it does take place, it does start to happen overnight. That there are now several, I think two or three major productions set to begin in the northeastern part of the state. There is the possibility of a HBO series in Stillwater, I believe, and the possibility of a major production coming to the Twin Cities. So the work is starting to come back. The crews are starting to come back. The acting pool is here. And unlike some of the other programs we have, where you will see hiring increased, jobs created, but over a gradual basis. In this case, and there's some quantification and some metrics that have been established, where you'll see a return of investment to the state in terms of direct tax dollars more significant than a lot of the other economic development work that happens. I said last comment. This will be the last comment. What you need, however, is a state office, because when you start trying to bring the production work in, they look for a central office. So absent a state office, it's not going to happen.
Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jill Johansson. I'm the incentive specialist at the Minnesota Film and Television Board. Thank you for taking the time to hear Senate File 2074, and thank you, Senator Cohen, not only for authoring this bill, but for your support of the film industry and all jobs it supports across the state. Every state, with the exception of North Dakota, has some kind of film commission, and almost 40 states have either a tax credit or rebate program. I want to point out the laminated map that you received earlier in your packets, which outlines Minnesota's domestic competition when it comes to attracting film production. Additionally, we also compete with Canada, which has both a national incentive and provincial incentives. These incentives are essential to attracting production and jobs to any state. Without them, a state has virtually no chance of attracting any film or television series of any magnitude and the resulting jobs and private spending that those projects bring. As the administrator of Minnesota's incentive program for the last 6 years, I see this firsthand every day. I review expenditures from the projects participating in our Snow Bay program. Since July of 2013, I have certified 80 projects that account for approximately $22 million in proposed Minnesota spending. A refundable tax credit is found in Senate File 2074 would immediately attract production and help build a vibrant industry that employs people at good wages. I'd like to turn it over now to Julie Hartley, a unit production manager, and Mark Steele, vice president of production at WorkWorkWorks, a Minnesota-based production company. They are two experienced members of our community who can speak to tax credits and how they can help advance the industry as a whole and encourage immediate economic development in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Before the next testifier, could I ask a couple of questions? Senator Cohen, currently there are appropriations made under the jobs program, and they are up to 25% of production costs. That's current law. Those are the incentives you're talking about?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I couldn't catch the last part of your question, but I think the answer is yes.
Right. So that's, we have the incentives you've been talking about are grants made for production costs for films located outside or inside the metropolitan area for up to $1 million. And so I just want to understand, you're proposing a refundable tax credit in addition to the funding that you have under current law?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, the answer to that would be yes. To be honest, there's some real uncertainty as to what would be more palatable to the legislature. And if this committee were to pass this bill and to incorporate it into an omnibus tax bill, obviously we'd have to track. We're not going to do this on a dual basis. I don't think Ms. Johansson can speak better than I can, but I don't think any state does this on a dual basis. And I'm not necessarily looking for that. But I'm trying to figure out what's most palatable to the legislature. So at the end of the day, we'd probably go one direction or the other.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
So are you proposing a repeal of 116U.26?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, not at this point, no. Because, again, Senator Ortman, you know, as a tax committee chair, in the course of this session, in fact, my best film analogy is a legislative session is like a Robert Altman movie, for those of you familiar with the Altman films. But as you know, there are always a million moving pieces. And, again, because there's some uncertainty as to what's going to be most palatable, I'm trying to keep both going on the same track. I'm trying to keep both going, and then as we finish the session over the next few weeks, try to determine which is the best way to go. So I'm not suggesting a repeal at this point, no.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, how much is the appropriation for 116U.26 in your bill so far this year?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, not my bill, Senator Tomasoni's bill, which will be on the floor today. The appropriation is, and this is another concern, Senator Ortman, this is why the tax credit maybe is a little bit easier of a mechanism. The appropriation in Senator Tomasoni's bill is $3 million for the biennium in the base, $1.5 million a year, and then an additional $10 million in one-time money. And that's why I thought this year might also take a look at the tax credit. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, I know we're not supposed to talk about the folks across the street. It's my understanding that a tax credit might be more palatable to them, possibly, than the general fund expenditure. So I certainly, I mean, you're correct. But again, I'll just, you know, given your experience and seniority in this body, as you well know, at this point in the session, again, trying to figure out what works. I'm not looking to pile on, however. And if it appeared at the end of the day in work with Chairman Skoy that this appeared to be a better route to go, then obviously we redirect the money in Senator Tomasoni's bill elsewhere.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman. Senator Ortman, I want to thank you for bringing this up so I don't have to.
No worries.
Senator Ortman.
Ms. McQuay tells me that you may have the base incorrect. Do you have the base, Ms. McQuay?
Mr. Chair and members, I may not be clear on what is the base and what is the Senate proposed increase, and I'm trying to get that answer right now, and I defer to the senator.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, if I can ask the committee to take my word for it, the amount for the current biennium is the $3 million in the base, 1.5, 1.5, and there was $7 million in one-time money over the 2 years of the biennium for a total of $10 million. The proposal in Senator Tomasoni's bill on the floor today is a continuance of the 1.5, 1.5 in the base, and an additional $3 million in one-time money for a total of $13 over the biennium, $10 million one-time money, $3 million base money versus current biennium, $3 million base money, $7 million one-time money.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I appreciate it, and I do take your word for it that you're not piling on, but it looks like a pile on to me. And I mean, just being honest, when I look at the revenue note, Senator, the taxpayers, the number of taxpayers affected by your tax credit proposal is about 20. That's an awful lot in addition to the base and one-time money that you're talking about here. It looks like a major expansion of the program in terms of the granting ability and the incentives available. And those are just my thoughts. If you wanted my support for the tax credit, I'd like to see the repeal language for 116U.26. But I'll also let you know I'm a little concerned about the refundable nature of the tax credit as well. So maybe you can address that and the need for a refund as opposed to working through the grant program, which is a more direct fashion. Are you trying to do direct or are you trying to do tax credits?
And Senator Ortman, we have a number of provisions that are being kind of jointly tracked as credits and grants, one of which is workforce housing. Our expectation, my expectation, is that we would only do one of the two. And as we move through the session, that will become clear which one is going to survive the process. And, you know, Senator Cohen's initiative here, you know, he's trying to do the same thing with this. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions I had was several states appear to do a refundable tax credit and several do a transferable tax credit. Who are they transferable to, and then any rationale why you picked one over the other?
Senator Cohen or Ms.
Johansson? I would ask Ms. Johansson.
Ms. Johansson?
I was going to defer to you, Senator.
Well,
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dietzick, it's my understanding that, that the states that have tax credits, and we haven't, that they have guidelines either written into rule or statute. Again, because we've always had the direct rebate, that's the program I'm most conversant with in terms of how it's handled. Ms. Winters here, who's the executive director of the Film Board, she might be able to offer the a little bit more of a detailed discussion as to the transferability of the tax credits, if she wants to.
Good morning. For the record, my name is
Ms. Hartley.
I'm Lucinda. I thought I would just answer this question. My name's Lucinda Winter. I work at Minnesota Film and TV as the executive director, and I will just answer the transferable versus refundable. They're both flavors of film credit are the sort of credit that other states provide. The refundable tax credit would if your tax liability. Let's just say you qualify for a $200,000 tax credit and your actual tax liability, corporate tax liability, ends up being $100,000, the state provides you with a check for the remainder. A transferable tax credit allows the creditor to sell that credit to someone who wants to buy a tax credit. So transferable tax credits are, in this case, are the same as all transferable tax credits. The person who receives the tax, the corporate, the entity that receives the tax credit, can put it on the market. There are people in the business who are brokers who broker these credits. Georgia, for example, is a state that has that sort of tax credit. And you can sell them on the market. You will take about 8% hit on the sale of the credit, and that can vary, but you do take a hit on the amount of the credit that you're netting out at less than the full face value of your credit. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Cohen, should we bring up the other two testifiers, Ms.
Certainly
Hartley
if we
and
can.
Mr. Steele?
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johansson. Who would like to go first? Mr. Steele.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Mark Steele. I'm Vice President of Production at WorkWorkWorks, which is a local film production company that was founded in Minneapolis in 2008. Over the course of the 5+ years that we've been in existence, we've spent about $30 million on film production, and all of those have been in states with tax incentives. So for us to do our business and continue to do business, we see the benefit of tax credits, and we do definitely support Minnesota continuing some sort of rebate program or grant program or incentive program, especially as the industry is changing, there's more content being produced, the potential to increase the business in Minnesota is really great. So in addition to, you know, cable outlets and digital outlets, the potential for business expansion is something that, you know, I think is really important for Minnesota, and to lose business to, you know, other states that are taking advantage of the Amazon and the Hulu is coming into town to do production in addition to the regular television shows and films, you know, to me, it's important for my home state to, you know, participate in that.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. Ms. Hartley?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Julie Hartley, and I am a freelance producer and production manager. I am a resident of the Marcy Homes neighborhood in Minneapolis. I'm a taxpayer, and I very rarely work in Minnesota. The sad part about that is because my job, I'm the person that does the budgets I allocate resources, and I'm asked on all of these projects how to manage those resources, and a big part of that is incentives. So the last, I brought an example. The last project I did, you all might be aware, it's coming out on May 8th. It's called Hot Pursuit with Reese Witherspoon and Sofia Vergara. And the original title of that was Don't Mess with Texas, and we shot it in Louisiana. And the reason we shot it in Louisiana is because of the tax incentives. And just to give you an idea about what a movie like that is, and I've been involved in the movies here that Senator Cohen has supported, and we have had some movies like this here. Joe Somebody was one, A Serious Man was another. For the movie Hot Pursuit, formerly Don't Mess with Texas, shot in Louisiana, we were there in Louisiana for 5 months, from March to August. In those 5 months, MGM spent $9,474,155 on goods and services. I know that because I track it. That's my job. In addition to that, we spent $9,098 on labor. $9 million on labor in 5 months. These are jobs we had approximately 350 full-time crew people. We pay them, by union regulations, anywhere from $30 to $75 an hour. In addition, we have several thousand extras, actors, and construction workers, and we pay them anywhere from $15 to $50 an hour. So as you can see, the labor, the job impact of something like this coming into a community is quite significant. And I would love it if we could get projects like that here and that I could stay at home and work.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry to interrupt Senator Orban. Can I just offer a couple of comments relative to the witness's testimony, if that's okay?
Sure. Senator Cohen.
First of all, relative to Mr. Steele, the owner and CEO of WorkWork, Ms. Redleaf, who I know, is a Minnesotan. I don't think actually originally from Minnesota, but she's lived here for years and years and has set up a production company. She's done some work here and some work elsewhere. And she's made it very clear to me she would love to, you know, do her work in Minnesota. Ms. Hartley, who probably has as much experience as anybody in the state on a variety of productions, has made it very clear that she's worked on some of the Minnesota-based productions and is compelled to go elsewhere. What I think Ms. Hartley might tell you is that when Minnesota was a significant production state, she was probably doing a lot of her work in Minnesota and only leaving the state occasionally. What's difficult, I think, for this legislature, and if you'll allow me a couple of comments. So folks know I'm involved with art stuff. This is not art stuff. You know, there are hopefully some very good movies. I think A Serious Man was a very good movie. I think Fargo was arguably a semi-classic. But there's some stuff here that's made here that, to be honest, isn't very good. But they're still employing Minnesotans and bringing money into the state. What's difficult, I think, for this legislature, and again, when I chaired state government, I spent a lot of time with some of the economic development programs. What's very difficult is to determine what is actually going to bring money into the state where we spend a tax dollar and get some return that we can see in terms of a realization to the state. I don't want to get this too far afield, but we make the argument, and I'm as strong of a supporter of the University of Minnesota as anybody, I would argue, in the body, but we've put money into biomedical research and facilities at the university in the hope that at some point, and this is only one part of it, obviously, but that we hope we might see some economic development. We might see the creation of the next Medtronic. That's not going to happen tomorrow or 5 years from now. That's what we're hoping to see with our investment in the University of Minnesota. We see many other things with some of that same money that is not economic development. We have economic development programs, and we'll discuss some of those on the floor today with Senator Tomasoni's bill, where we've been able to put money into what we've considered to be more traditional economic development, and we see some return against some of that's not immediate. I think one of the advantages to the film board is that there's an immediacy to the return and a return that is more significant than the tax dollars we put in, and three, that absent having that state office, we don't have that. And I'm not suggesting that the establishment of the film board, the film and television board, and an appropriate funding of the incentive, whether through tax credits or general fund appropriations, will increase employment in the state by hundreds of thousands of people. But you will see the synergy of an industry. And what's kind of sad about this whole thing over these last X number of years is Minnesota had the strongest possibility, with a couple of exceptions, to having the creation, for the reasons I mentioned, of a significant production industry. And that's been what's been kind of lost in the translation with what's happened. So I just want to kind of make that general point that there's some advantages, some natural advantages to Minnesota that we're losing, kind of like, you know, losing our advantage with an ag economy, where we've had that natural advantage.
And Senator Cohen, I understand that the legislature has activity, and we hope to have a result that's beneficial to the state. Hence, Senator Ress's initiative on the R&D credit and other initiatives like your effort here with the film board credit. What we'll do is reach out and try to bring information in to see what other states and what kind of results they're having, and hence the sheet that's handed out by the film board. There is a study that's posted on the Massachusetts Department of Revenue website. It's been reported in the state tax notes in the Boston Globe that does have some information from Massachusetts. And their credit study is from 2012, found that most of the economic benefits went out of state. One-third of the $304 million in spending generated was spent in state, and of the 2,000 jobs created by the credit, one-third went to in-state residents. So I think there's some information that we should be kind of utilizing here as we explore the grant, credit, where we spend our resources. Senator Cohen.
And Mr. Chairman, my comment is, I'd like to take a look at the Massachusetts study. I haven't seen that. My comment would be that, again, what I mentioned at the outset is Minnesota has had some unique advantages. Again, we have a much stronger secondary acting pool than Massachusetts does. And let me just make it very clear. This is where you have kind of the intersection of this economic development and the arts. Minnesota has more theaters per capita. I should say the Twin Cities, to be fair. There's some significant theaters beyond the Twin Cities in Minnesota, you know, Commonweal and Lanesboro, for instance. The Twin Cities have more theaters per capita than any city in the country other than New York City, more so than Boston, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, any place. We're second only to New York. That means that we have a strong secondary acting pool. So if you see some of the films that Ms. Hartley's worked on, you'll see a lot of Minnesota residents in those secondary roles. Most notable example might be Fargo. And I guess it may be A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers movies, but Fargo was replete with Minnesota actors in the secondary roles. And so I would guess in the state of Massachusetts, you don't have that secondary – oh, I know you don't have that secondary acting pool that you have in Boston, that you have in Minneapolis-St. Paul. So I would guess that – and Ms. Hartley and Mr. Seale could speak this better than I could – that you would see more Minnesotans employed than you might see in other states because we have them here, if we're going to maintain the industry or build up the industry.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, a question for Ms. Hartley while she's here. I'm so grateful for you, your presence today, and your expertise. Can you tell me what the Louisiana tax incentives or credits were so that I can determine how they might compare to what we offer here in Minnesota? Are we competitive?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ms. Hartley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ortman, Louisiana offers a 30% tax credit. And so what that very similar to what we do, it's offered on local residents, on local goods and services. They also have a significant incentive on above the line, which Minnesota's does not. And that's now what's determining the reason that Louisiana and Georgia have risen to the top of incentive states. Right now there are 28 feature films shooting in Atlanta, Georgia. And I know of at least 10 that are in Louisiana at this given time. Part of it is because of that above-the-line component And they have no cap on their incentives. So that's what brings the bigger pictures, the ones that are going to spend the more money, like the Avengers or trying to think. There's huge ones down there right now. Jurassic Park, excuse me, is another one because they get that above-the-line advantage. But in terms of the below-the-line, they've got the additional 10% on goods and services and on labor.
Senator Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Hartley, thank you. That's very good information, and I think we should be looking at what other states are doing to see if we're going to be competitive. The proposal, I think, is, I'm sure, not as much as Senator Cohen would really like to advocate for here today. Another question for you, Ms. Hartley. If, as a budget production manager, would you prefer, if Minnesota had to choose one, between a refundable tax credit, as is proposed here, versus the grant program out of our 116U, which one would you think would be the most effective to draw film producers here to Minnesota?
Ms. Hartley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman. Both of them are advantageous. I'd also just like to speak momentarily to the Massachusetts study, which I'm aware of, because at the time that one came out, I was in New Mexico. I spent 2 years in New Mexico working there because of their incentives. And the difference that I think between the study that was done in Mexico, New Mexico, which shows a more positive economic output, was New Mexico, like Minnesota, or more like Minnesota to somebody like me, has been built steadily building over the last 10 years, 15 years, the infrastructure, which a place like Massachusetts does not have, as Senator Cohen mentioned. What they've done, and what I think Minnesota is doing and can do, is to build that infrastructure, create those jobs, have that talent base, all of those things that a state like Massachusetts, I've shot in Boston, and what happens in Boston and some of these other states is that you have to bring everybody in. And that's not the goal. That's not my goal. My goal is to take advantage of as many resources, labor, jobs that you have and that you can get an incentive for that actually then builds that infrastructure. And as you do each of these projects, that infrastructure grows. The more people you can bring in, the less outside services you need to hire. The difference for me in my position between the rebate and the transferable tax credit is oftentimes the tax credit will attract larger projects. It goes to the sale of these tax credits and the brokering of them. So as the tide rises, it floats more boats. You have brokers. You have larger consumers of those tax credits. The rebates are extremely helpful for the medium to smaller size projects. The ones that need a more immediate return, the studios like the tax credits, the independent producers like the rebates.
Senator Irvin.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I don't believe that Senator Cohen has proposed a transferable credit, but a refundable credit. My question was, if you had to choose the incentive of a tax refund versus a grant program at the outset, so our current 116U, which one would be the most effective economic development tool to encourage film production here in Minnesota?
I think I heard her say both. Ms.
Well, I heard that too. I'm wondering which one she, because Senator Cohen has said we are going to choose, and I'd like to know which one she thinks is most effective.
Ms. Hartley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, from my position, and oftentimes I answer to somebody else. I do budgets for Fox Searchlight. I do budgets for MGM. I do budgets for Relativity. So for the studios, actually when it comes to me, they don't specify, quite honestly. We'll do a budget, whether it be $15 million to $70 million, and we have industry software that takes that credit that we program, and it does not indicate. The rebate, typically the rebate will be 100%. And the tax credit will be, you have to sell it. So as Lucinda mentioned, you're going to get a discount of anywhere between 7 and 10%. But the credits typically do not have a cap where the rebates do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure you have answered my question yet, and maybe you don't want to answer the question. But we need your advice here to say, should we be doing the grant program up front through the 116U program, or should we be doing the tax credits? And maybe Mr. Steele would like to answer that question.
Senator Ortman, I'm hearing that it's a more complicated decision than just today deciding. But Mr. Steele.
Mr. Chair, Committee, and Senator Ortman, my brief answer to that question is if the dollar amount is the same, it's equally as effective in trying to bring production into the state. The one caveat is when you have a tax credit, regardless of the flavor of the tax credit, sometimes it's if you have more sophisticated financing needs, sometimes it's easier to put your TV show, your movie together because it is easier to go out to market and try to essentially get a loan against that tax credit. So in those situations, it is a little bit easier, which to Ms. Hartley's comment, that does sometimes attract the bigger studios because they love to finance and not use their own money. So,
thank you.
Anything else, members? Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you know, I think there's probably some of us around the table that wish we didn't have to play this game of tax credits or grants or whatever the case might be, but we live in a real world, and that's kind of the way it is. It's a free agency kind of situation out there, and organizations, film organizations included, are going to go to the places that they can get the best deal, if you will, and I don't blame them. That's the way it is. And I think a little bit of, and I think Senator Cohen's right. I mean, just instincts here from the standpoint of Minnesota, you know, when I got involved in this medical device tax thing and come to understand and find out that Minnesota is like paying 25% of the Obamacare medical device tax for the whole country, that means that something's happened in our state, and we have a congregation of people here that are intellectually around that kind of product and are doing things. And likewise, the angel investment tax credits and all those things we try to do. I know from Rochester we're seeing a lot of activity down there by small companies that are starting up and probably wouldn't because of if there weren't these sort of tax advantages available. And likewise, I do kind of think that Minnesota is probably one of these places where we have a congregation of people that if we incent them, and I'm talking about the people involved in the film industry, actors and others, that we probably have a pool of people here that maybe we don't even realize, perhaps Senator Cohen does better than I do, but that could really make this go if we gave it a little jump start. So I'm willing to ride with him on this one.
Let me ask if there's anybody else who wished to testify on Senate File 2074. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate all the time and the committee's willingness at this point in the session to listen to us. I would offer a couple other things just to follow up on. I appreciate Senator Senjum's comment. You know, I wish we could go back to the days of 20 years ago when Minnesota, like I said, was a major production center in this country and did so based on our homegrown advantages. The incentives developed in the last 10, 15 years, and that's the reality that we live with. But there still is the ability to put together a significant production center, again, because of these homegrown advantages. And Mr. Chairman, again, with the comparison, Ms. Hartley did it better than I did, compared to the Massachusetts study, where you don't have the homegrown advantages. The other comment I would make that we haven't talked about, and this always gets a little bit slippery when we talk about economic development. We do this whether it's, you know, the Minnesota Vikings or anything else. What is the spin-off economic activity? And I'll just, if I can, just from an anecdotal basis, because we've talked about trying to create a production center with full-time employment with jobs in Minnesota, and I think that's at the heart of it. But secondary to that, and maybe there are some members who saw the production North Country, which was shot in northeastern Minnesota. It was a relatively major production, had top-of-the-line talent, Charlize Theron, Woody Harrelson, Sissy Spacek. And so I was going to join Governor Plenty on the set, and he was going to spend some time with the producer of the movie. And so I went up the night before, was going to have breakfast with the producer, kind of set him up for talking to the governor. And I just left here, went home, drove up north, and I couldn't find a place to stay. The movie was shot in Virginia and Eveleth. I drove around for about 2.5 hours before, on this cold night, before I found a place where I could actually spend the night. And in talking to some of the folks from there and the folks in our body, Senator Tomasoni in particular, who represents the area, apparently for those several months, those towns were packed in terms of restaurants, motel, hotel space. So that's the advantage of bringing in some of the outside folks, is you do have that boost to the economy, albeit potentially on a temporary basis. But if you multiply this on an ongoing basis, you have that kind of secondary economic development, not just what takes place with what's more important, the creation of a production base.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Anything else, members? Seeing nothing, thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Lee, Senate File 2074 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Cohen.
And I can go back upstairs and talk about human services. So.
That is it for Senator Orman.
Mr. Chair, just a question about the schedule. The education bill, will we be seeing the education bill? And when will we see that bill? Do you know?
Senator Orman, it depends on when finance gets those bills out of committee. I was just going to announce that Thursday has been canceled. We had planned on hearing transportation then, but it's not to us. Friday, we will meet if we get the transportation bill from finance. Monday, we are scheduled to hear the education bill, and if we don't do transportation on Friday, we'll do it Monday. And the rollout of the tax bill will be early next week, depending upon the schedule of these finance bills in committee. So we're kind of tied up right now till we get these finance bills from committee.
Mr. Chair, just one final thing. You are intending to send a tax bill up to the floor.
Senator Ortman, that's my intention.
Thank you.
Seeing nothing else, committee's adjourned.